This is our State Capitol Report, when we recap the top stories in state politics, and we take a look at the issues expected to make news in the week to come as well. We will spend the next hour getting you up to speed on the latest developments in the recall effort, and what policy changes made it through the special legislative session that ended last week. And we will welcome your input as well. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8 minutes past 7 o'clock on this Monday, November the 7th. Our state government reporter, Sean Johnson, is here. And for some additional analysis, we also invited Assistant Professor of Political Science at St. Norbert College in De Pere, Charlie Johnson, to also join us. And we would love to hear from you, too. Your questions, your reactions to the latest news in state politics. We will start with, are you ready for the recall? But we will move on to many issues as the hour goes along. And I should have said Charlie Jacobs, not Johnson. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page, or you can tweet us on Twitter at Joy Cardine Show. Well, let me welcome our guest. Sean Johnson is Wisconsin Public Radio state government reporter. He joins us by telephone. Good morning.
Morning, Joy.
So, Sean, you think you can have the week off, huh?
Just a day, anyway.
I'm just teasing. Sean is joining us from his in-laws' place, I believe, right?
Actually, my parents.
Okay, your parents' place. Thanks for joining us on your day off. And also, Charlie Jacobs is with us, Assistant Professor of Political Science at St. Norbert College in De Pere. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Thanks to both of you for being with us. Let's start with the recall news. On Friday, someone filed a petition to start the recall. Who was this someone, Sean?
Nobody really knows the person other than they have a record of donating at least small amounts of money to the governor and to the Republican Party. And so it doesn't matter what this person's intentions were. Because they have filed a recall petition against the governor, basically that opens the spigot in terms of how much money the governor is allowed to raise. Right now, for the period while this recall petition is out against him, which would be 60 days, he has no limits to the amount of money that he can raise as long as that money is used to fend off a recall effort. Yeah. So beginning November 4th, instead of the November 15th that Democrats were hoping for, that unlimited fundraising, you know, option is open for the governor.
Yeah, and so Democrats, though, are saying they're still going to start their real effort on November the 15th?
Yeah, that's when, I mean, this effort, you know, this person may get, you know, one signature, two signatures, 100, whatever. It won't affect the signature petition drive that Democrats and unions and their allies are going to start on November 15th. That'll be separate from this one. Although once that signature drive is open, that starts another 60-day clock under which those same fundraising rules apply for the incumbent, in this case Governor Walker, where he's allowed to exceed the current $10,000 cap on donations by any amount. I mean, you know, let your imagination run wild there.
Yeah. Well, Professor Jacobs, does this matter?
I don't think it matters very much at all. One wonders how well, or if at all, even the Walker campaign and the Walker anti-recall effort was aware of it. So the few days extra that you get probably didn't have much effect on fundraising. And so I don't think that the governor is particularly worried or anxious or eager to raise money yet, especially since you don't even know the extent to which the recall effort is going to generate the necessary signatures. So I'm not sure whether or not this was an advantage, a quirk, but I'm not sure whether or not it was helpful to the governor at all.
Yeah, but this person who filed this this intent of a recall, Sean, he is someone who donated to the governor in the past, so we presume he is a supporter of the governor's, not someone who wants him recalled.
Yeah, I mean, you could presume that based on a read of who he's donated to, just you know, nominal amounts, $50 to the governor, and you know, some money to the state Republican Party as well. And generally, a Democrat, somebody who wants the governor recalled, wouldn't do that. But you know, he wasn't reached by any media outlets on Friday, so nobody's heard from him personally on his intentions.
Mm-hmm. Other news last week, the Attorney General, J.B. Van Hollen, ruled on a question that he got from the Government Accountability Board as to whether Governor Walker and Lieutenant Governor Rebecca Clayfish would need to be recalled separately. What's the verdict? What's the ruling, Sean?
Yeah, well, there was some question as to whether they could be recalled together as the Walker ticket. You know, the Walker Walker and his lieutenant governor, Rebecca Clayfish. Attorney General Van Hollen was asked to review that legal question by the Government Accountability Board, and he said that if you want to recall them both, you have to circulate petitions against both of them. And he said, legally speaking, it wasn't a close call.
The recall aspects of the Constitution are quite clear that each individual office has to have its individual recall petitions and its individual recall elections. So if someone wishes to recall Governor Walker and Lieutenant Governor Clayfish, they basically have to have two separate recall drives and two separate recall elections.
So are Democrats or those who want to recall Governor Walker going to heed that that ruling?
Well, I mean, they have to heed it. It sounds like they're still talking about recalling Lieutenant Governor Clayfish, though, which would mean getting signatures for her as well. So, you know, in addition to the 540,000 signatures plus that you'd need to recall the governor, you're talking about getting probably that same universe of people to sign off on Rebecca Clayfish's petition, too.
Yeah. So that doubles the difficulty of this this task, Professor Jacobs?
Well, it depends. I don't know whether or not there's been any ruling about whether or not, in essence, you have to have totally separate petition drives or whether or not you can just sort of double up and there can be economy of scale. If you're pursuing the governor on one street corner soliciting signatures on a petition, you can probably also do that for the lieutenant governor at the same time. The question, of course, is whether or not they want to confuse the matter, Democrats do, in their recall drive against the governor, or whether or not they actually think the lieutenant governor might be, if she's not recalled, a suitable candidate to run against whomever will be on the ballot against a Democrat. So I think that there's a strategic concern here, but I'm not sure whether or not it really compounds the issue of getting the half a million signatures or more that are necessary here.
Remember that also that in some districts they're going to be not only asking for potentially, hey, could you sign this for the governor and could you sign this for the lieutenant governor? You're going to have quite a few Senate districts potentially where they're going to say, and also while I've got your attention, would you like to recall this senator as well?
Oh, that yeah. They're speaking of senators and their potential recall, Sean, tell us what happened when Republicans in the state legislature wanted to speed up the date when the new redistricting maps took effect.
This is something that we talked about last Monday. It was an idea that had just been put out there. It was going to be held, going to have a public hearing that day, going to be voted on the next day. And it kind of hit a wall when State Senator Dale Schultz, a Republican from Richland Center, said that he would not vote for it. Basically, what this would have done is, if there are more recalls of state senators next year, under current law, those recalls would be held under the current legislative map, the one that was drawn roughly a decade ago. And that map is pretty competitive. And if you're a Democrat, you kind of like your chances in a few of the districts that would be up for recall next year. The map that Republicans wanted to have those districts run on, the one that they drew and passed this past summer, is much friendlier to Republicans. Again, with Dale Schultz's opposition, that plan appears dead. There was another proposal in there that would have required recall circulators to get their petitions notarized. The proponents said that would cut down on fraud, but that's another one that not sure exactly what the conversation was on that, but Republicans held a private caucus, discussed these things, and those bills did not emerge and did not go to the floor for a vote.
Yeah. Your thoughts, Professor Jacobs, on this attempt?
Well, I think part of the issue too is whether or not there would be some sort of constitutional infirmity. You'd have people who were recalling an individual for whom they never had the opportunity to vote, and you know, the United States Supreme Court has, you know, over the last half century or so, issued a number of rulings on the process of reapportionment, the process of voting, and who gets to vote when and why. And so I think that there would have been at least a legal question that would have wound up in the courts regarding whether or not that's even proper. Again, this is one of those questions we keep sort of going into these gray areas in Wisconsin this year about exactly what's appropriate and what's typical, and we don't have answers. So I think there would have been some serious issues related to it which would have gummed up the works. And to a certain extent, I think that the Republican caucus probably recognized that this might complicate matters in a way that would make it even more difficult to defend themselves. So just sort of move ahead with the potential recall in the districts that exist today.
Yeah. Now, Senator Schultz, last week, Sean had the outside of his office egged. Is there any word as to whether this was retaliation for him not going along with Republicans on this issue?
I don't know. I mean, I can only speculate like everyone else. It happened. I think it may have been the day after he announced he wasn't going to vote for that bill.
But no one's been arrested on this.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And one other issue that involves, I guess, recall politics to a certain extent is happening not in Wisconsin, but in Ohio tomorrow. Sean, what does it look like in terms of that collective bargaining law in Ohio?
Yeah, well, you know, people may not have realized that Ohio basically went through the same sort of battle, maybe not as dramatic. I would say not as dramatic as what we had in Wisconsin, but they passed a law that's very similar, probably even tougher than what we have here in terms of curbing bargaining rights for public employee unions. Tougher in that it also went after police and firefighters there, whereas our law exempted them. They don't have recalls in Ohio, but they do have a referendum process where voters, if they get enough signatures, they can put a question on the ballot on whether you want to keep a new law or reject it. And so that's the question that's going to be on the ballot there tomorrow in Ohio. And if public polling that's been released on this issue is any guide, it looks like Ohio's collective bargaining law is probably going to get voted down.
Yeah, so that'll be repealed. Professor Jacobs, does it look like that?
Oh, it does. And full disclosure, I have a brother-in-law who's a deputy sheriff in Youngstown.
Oh, really?
And they are animated, to say the least. If you weren't aware of this, the governor basically tried to do a side deal with opponents. After the fact, when it looked like the initiative was going to wind up on the ballot, he was trying to sort of backpedal and see whether or not he could ameliorate some of their concerns and worries. And in essence, they said to him, you know, the horse is out of the barn, and so you're going to have to deal with the public's wrath on this. Some of the polls have opposition as high as 57-58% on this issue. So I agree with Sean. This thing has a very, very good chance of going down.
Yeah, and we in Wisconsin do not have this option. Is that right, Professor Jacobs?
That's correct. Mm. I mean, these kinds of mechanisms are on a state-by-state approval, and some states use more of these direct democratic processes than others. To a certain extent, one could argue that this is an effective way to try to control policymaking without having to go through this effort of recalling an individual. But at the same time, generally speaking, in these kinds of referendum initiatives, you see very low turnout. So you have a small percentage of the public actually participating in whether or not these kinds of initiatives stay as law or are enacted into law.
We are talking with Charlie Jacobs, Assistant Professor of Political Science at St. Norbert College in De Pere, and Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio State Government Reporter, during this edition of the State Capitol Report. We are talking about the very latest in state politics, including the latest recall news. We'll take some of your questions about the recall effort in Wisconsin, which got an early start last Friday. And we will also talk about all of the public policy issues that are moving through the state legislature. The state legislature concluded its special session on jobs last week. Democrats charge that it was a special session on everything but jobs. And we'll welcome your thoughts and questions on some of the many bills that moved through. Some are on the governor's desk or will soon be. Others still need a little bit more legislative action. Things like the Castle Doctrine, sex education, capping attorney fees, and a whole lot more. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. It's going to be a sunny, mild day today statewide with highs in the upper 40s in the north to the upper 50s in the south. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, hoping you'll stay tuned. Coming up, it's the first Monday of the month, which means it's time for another edition of Mondays with Mike. Mike Crane, the director of Wisconsin Public Radio, will be in after 8 o'clock to answer your questions and respond to your feedback about Wisconsin Public Radio. That's coming up after 8. This is the State Capitol Report, where we are talking with Wisconsin Public Radio state government reporter Sean Johnson. And because so much is going on, we have two guests and the full hour devoted to what happened at the state capitol last week. Charlie Jacobs, assistant professor of political science at St. Norbert College, also joins us. Lots of questions about the recall, and Bob in Madison is with us first. Hello, Bob.
Good morning, and thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I am a senior. I really mean that. I worked for the state in the early 1950s under the merit system. I left the state for private. My question is this: why isn't there a reason have to be given for a recall? What's the reason? This guy Walker, he's another governor. He's doing what he thinks is right, just as Proxmire did what he would do. You know, our previous governors, Lucy, we go back to Lucy and that stuff. It seems to me that you can recall anybody because I don't like the guy.
Yeah. Well, what does the law say, Professor Jacobs?
Well, that's it. I mean, if you want a recall, there doesn't have to be a substantive justification. If you can convince your fellow citizens that this person should be removed from office and you make a meritorious argument, then they can be recalled from office. It is one of those sort of conundrums of this process, because I think there are at least justifiable arguments to suggest we should just let the individual run through their term and at the end of the term evaluate their entire behavior in office and then make a decision then. But, of course, the process of recall is supposed to be there in case somebody acts in an egregious fashion. What's egregious? That's hard to define. Sort of like, why should we impeach a president? It's technically a political question that's going to be defined by the House of Representatives. We get to decide what rises to the level that requires a recall of a political official. So, frustrating, yes, but if you can get a half a million or more of your citizens to agree, there must be some substance behind the charge.
Yeah, and Sean, why are the people who are trying to recall Governor Walker saying they want to recall Governor Walker?
It all started with the collective bargaining battle, and you name it. After that, they would give you a lot of reasons, but clearly that was the impetus for the recall effort.
Yeah, and another question: somebody who couldn't stay with us wants to know if the 60 days that you need to collect this half million signatures, does that start on Friday when the first an intent of recall petition was filed, or does it start on November the 15th when the Democrats are planning to start theirs?
If I can say this in a way that makes sense, let's say that the guy who filed the recall petition last Friday has every intent of going out and trying to get those signatures. The clock for him started Friday, and he has 60 days to try to do that. But that's his recall effort. It's separate from the one that is going to be launched on November 15th by Democrats and unions. And that's the big one. And they have their own 60-day clock that starts on November 15th. They're not affected by the papers that he filed last Friday.
Yeah. And another was wondering if this recall effort by the Republican supporter of Governor Walker's was a move to try to confuse the real recall effort by Democrats? And what if people sign his petition and not the Democrats' petition? Professor Jacobs, any thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, it could be used as sort of a ruse to get people to sign, and then if asked again, the individual might say, well, I've already signed, and so I don't need to duplicate this process. And the original filer on Friday could just refuse to turn in petitions. So there is an effort, or there could be a coordinated effort to try to undermine it. I'm not sure whether or not that's the case here. It seems somewhat unclear as to exactly what the motivations of this individual were, and it doesn't seem as though there's an organization behind it. So I'm not sure whether or not it would achieve that end. Sometimes we ascribe sort of motivations to individuals that just don't exist.
Yeah. And there was another poll that came out last week, Professor Jacobs, two in the last week or so, that shows the state is pretty much evenly divided, maybe even slightly against recalling the governor, but pretty much a 50-50 split. This is not going to be an easy task for those who want to recall him.
I don't think it's going to be an easy task at all. And if you think about the timeline, there are certain benefits, I think, to filing when they are in the middle of November. But at the same time, there are going to be a lot of distractions for members of the public. You have the holidays coming up. It's getting colder. There are so many things that might interfere with the ability of those who seek to recall the governor to actually get the signature, get volunteers to participate. When you're extended during the holidays and during these kinds of months, it's going to impede these efforts. Now, I say that, of course, but I also believe that there might be problems with the earlier recalls with the Senate for different but sort of similar kinds of reasons, and yet they made their marks in most of the districts. So, I mean, this is sort of navel gazing or crystal ball gazing here. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult to get a sense, but I have a feeling that with the colder months coming and the holidays coming, it's going to be a pretty high hurdle to get over.
We will check news from National Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Radio, and then we'll talk about what the state legislature did last week. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. This is our State Capitol Report on this Monday, November the 7th. It is 7:36, talking with Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio State Government Reporter, and Charlie Jacobs, Assistant Professor of Political Science at St. Norbert College. Talked a lot in our first half hour about the latest developments in the recall effort against Governor Walker and Lieutenant Governor Clayfish, for that matter. Now let's turn our attention to the special session that ended last week, as a lot happened and only a half hour to go now. Sean, some Democrats were saying that this was not a special session on jobs, that this was a special session on anything but jobs. Were a lot of jobs bills passed?
Well, if you look at the bills that the governor included on his special session call when he called what he termed his back to work special session, he had 26 plans there that basically had his endorsement. 14 of those passed in the special session. As far as we know, through past week, 14 have passed. And the reason I put it that way is because the special session is still technically hanging out there. I mean, like many special sessions in Wisconsin, they're sort of amorphous. You don't exactly know where they begin and end, and the legislature still could come back to deal with stuff. But as of the legislature's regularly scheduled floor period for 2011, and they're not scheduled to be back in Madison, 14 of the 26 back-to-work bills were passed. And the governor was asked whether that was a success in his mind, and he said that, you know, it was.
Well, not every one of those bills was passed. We got a good chunk of them passed. I think that's a good sign for businesses in the state looking for stability, for certainty, for a partner in state government. And we're going to work on some of the other bills that were not passed, as well as some other ideas with the legislature in the coming months ahead.
So I stand corrected. The special session did not end last week, but at least the debate and floor session is what, adjourned until January?
It's the regularly scheduled session is adjourned until January, yeah. So if the legislature is going to come back now to deal with stuff, It would have to be legitimately a special session. I mean, they have to be called back to deal with certain bills, and that could happen. But right now, they're not scheduled to come back.
Yeah. Your thoughts, Professor Jacobs, on whether this was a special session on jobs?
I think this is one of those issues about definition and what exactly you consider a jobs bill. I mean, to a certain extent, virtually any piece of legislation is going to affect the job. So the Republicans and the governor can make the claim that all the bills passed had something to do with jobs in the long run. But I think from most neutral observers, the bills won't have a substantive kind of impact on the development of jobs. Certainly, some of them may help, and maybe in the long run help significantly. But I think in the near term, and that's what I think citizens of Wisconsin are really worried about, it doesn't seem as though there will have a large effect from this session of the Assembly.
Yeah. And there was the Assembly Democrats tried to pass some jobs bills, Sean?
Yeah, this was sort of a quirk of the way the session wrapped up. You actually had, because a number of the governor's special session bills didn't go anywhere, and remember when he introduced these, there was more of a bipartisan flair to this special session, and a number of them were co-sponsored or sponsored by Democrats. And so at the end of session, Democrats were saying, hey, the governor has approved these. You actually had Assembly Democratic Minority Leader Peter Barca trying to bring to the floor a bill that would increase an investment in a manufacturing training program at tech colleges by $400,000. And here was Peter Barca on the floor telling Republicans, look, this is something that your governor supports.
He put this on the call. He felt this was urgent. And he's right. It is urgent.
And it was actually Republican Robin Voss of Burlington saying, we can't afford this right now.
If you remember, the bill just increases the amount. It's not a brand new program. So I respect that you think money is unlimited and it grows on trees and we'll just be able to go pick some more off, but I don't agree with that.
So that was a bill that passed the Senate 32-1. You know, clearly some differences over there in the Assembly where you did have some members saying we're not going to pass bills just for the theater of a bipartisanship.
Now, didn't Representative Voss author a bill to cap attorneys' fees that passed last week?
Yeah, and that was one of the special session bills that did pass. This was one that had the endorsement of the governor, and it would cap attorneys' fees at three times compensatory damages. And this is something where trial lawyers, consumer advocates, turned out to testify against this. They said that basically what you're doing is lawyers will be okay, but that consumer who wants to bring a small claims case of less than, say, $10,000, they're going to have a hard time finding an attorney to take that case if that attorney can't be assured that their fees are going to be covered, that their costs are going to be covered. That was largely the argument that West Dallas Democrat Tony Stiskunas made on the Assembly floor last week.
The lawyers aren't going to be hurt. You're not hurting any lawyers tonight by voting for this bill. What you're hurting are your constituents who have been taken advantage of.
So you mentioned Representative Voss. He was the author of this plan. It didn't come out until the day before they're going to vote on it that he has a company that owns property, a landlord business, and is actually involved in one of these disputes where he faces up to $20,000 in legal fees. A lot of Democrats said that was a conflict of interest. Representative Voss got it cleared from the Government Accountability Board and addressed the issue in the Assembly floor last week.
If the bill had been passed before the lawsuit was filed, yes, then it would have. But because the lawsuit was already filed, it has no impact on me.
But his case is one of those cases where, opponents of this bill were saying, while it was up in committee, this is the type of case where a tenant won't be able to bring a case in the future because if you cap these fees, they're just not going to be able to get a lawyer.
Yeah. Any analysis of Professor Jacobs as to whether this this hurts attorneys or hurts consumers or anything else?
Well, it hurts the individuals who do have these small claims, as Sean suggests. I mean, the courts are places where individuals who have, you know, who feel harmed have a place to go. And, of course, they can't go there if they don't have the resources to pursue the case in court. And, of course, one of the ways in which you can do this is make sure that your lawyer is compensated. The only reason a lawyer is going to take your case is if they get something substantial out of the case to cover at least their basic costs. This is going to significantly restrict the use of courts by individuals who really have some very high stakes in the outcomes of individual cases. And, I mean, I can't stress this enough with individuals. This is going to really harm the little guy who has invested, you know, a substantial portion of disposable income, say if you're a tenant, in something like a security deposit. And if your landlord holds it and won't return it, either for valid or for possibly trumped up reasons, you're not going to have any recourse to get it back. And, you know, Representative Voss, to his credit, did say, you know, this isn't going to affect the case, but of course he's a landlord going forward. So it is going to have an impact on the way he does business with his own tenants. And so there's a real issue here with the way in which individuals are going to be able to use the courts to their advantage. And there's a huge literature in the study of judicial politics about this and the way in which what we often call one-shotters, people who often only go to court once in their life or a couple of times in their life, are going to get harmed and are really going to be impacted by those who have more power and resources to use the courts to their advantage.
Yeah, I see here, Sean, that there were some other tenants' rights ordinances overturned.
Well, this one didn't get nearly as much play, but this is a bill that that said that local communities couldn't have tougher tenants, you know, rights protections than exist under state law. And so, if you've got a community like Madison, which has a very lengthy list of tenants' rights ordinances, with, you know, the student population in mind here, perhaps, you know, they will not be able to have something that's tougher than the states under the plan that passed this week.
Yeah, and then there was also a bill that would let me, if I'm a plaintiff, sue the state, get to choose my venue, the county that I decide to file suit in?
Yes. Right now, if you want to sue the state, you are suing the state in Dane County, and this plan would let you choose the venue. And I mean, it's in a way, it's as simple as that. Proponents say that, you know, there's no reason every suit has to be in Dane County, that if you open it up to other counties, somebody, you know, let's say a farmer who has a problem up in, I don't know, Iron County, they could bring a suit there instead of having the burden of coming down to the seat of state government. But opponents of this bill say that it's going to let people venue shop, that they'll try to find the judge and the court that's most likely to fit their ends.
Yeah. Professor Jacobs, this is maybe because some think that the judges in Dane County are too liberal or what?
That's the charge. One of the issues here, too, is that by consolidating all the cases in one county, it means, in essence, you're creating a de facto specialized court because they deal with these issues over and over and over again, and they have a real competency when it comes to cases against the state. If you start to let any court in the state deal with that, you're going to have judges who are often unfamiliar with some of the intricacies of this law dealing with these cases. And as Sean suggests, you know, you can shop for a particular judge or a particular court that's going to rule more favorably for you. So by having everything in Dane County, it means that more often than not, you're probably going to get the right answer simply because the judges see these cases over and over and over and over again.
Oh, boy, we got so much to talk about. A Marine in Mineral Point asks, does the new sex education bill mean that teaching contraception and other methods of birth control is no longer required in Wisconsin classrooms? Sean, what's the latest on this bill?
The way things stand under current law, this is the law that was passed last session when Democrats were in charge, if you teach sex ed in a Wisconsin school, then you have to teach about contraceptives. Under the bill that passed the Senate, and you know, this is not on the governor's desk yet, but under the bill that passed the Senate, it would be up to a local school district to decide whether or not they wanted to teach about contraceptives in their sex ed class. But they would have to teach that marriage and abstinence are the best options.
Yeah. So, Professor Jacobs, what we saw here was what?
well, I mean, it's to a certain extent, it's a little bit of micromanaging, but I just think it's the Republican majorities recognizing that they have the power, and so if they have a particular policy objective, they're going to pursue it. And I don't find anything, quite honestly, unusual or remarkable about that particular decision, outside of sort of the policy itself.
But just so I'm clear on this, it's not quite at the governor's desk. There still needs to be some agreement of both houses, Sean. But this would essentially say that you can teach sex education in your school, but you must, if you do talk about abstinence as the best policy.
Right. You would have to promote marriage and tell students abstinence is the only reliable way to prevent pregnancy.
And a local school board could say we're not talking about contraceptives at all.
Correct.
Yeah.
But you wouldn't have the, every district would have that flexibility, but they wouldn't have flexibility to say, to not teach about abstinence.
Well, we have other topics to talk about from the state legislature last week, including bills involving education and using test scores to as a factor in a decision to fire a teacher or not. Also, the Castle Doctrine is I believe on the governor's desk. We'll talk about what that means, and we welcome your input too. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. It's going to be a sunny, mild day today. Highs between 47 and 57 degrees. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the State Capitol Report here on the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. Stay tuned. Coming up after 8 this morning, it's Mike Crane. First Monday of the month with Mike Crane, the director of Wisconsin Public Radio. You can call in with your questions and your feedback about what you hear or don't hear on Wisconsin Public Radio. This is our State Capitol Report. We're trying to recap a very busy week in state politics last week with Sean Johnson, our State Capitol reporter, and Charlie Jacobs, an assistant professor of political science at St. Norbert College. Let's talk, Sean, next about this bill that passed that would... It would allow the using test scores as a factor when firing teachers. What's this about?
Yeah, and this is part of a pretty broad bill that Republicans billed as their mandate relief plan. And the portion about test scores says that you can't use test scores as the only factor to fire a teacher, but you can use them as a factor when disciplining or firing a teacher. Elkhart Lake Republican sponsor Steve Castell said the plan didn't mandate anything.
What there is a relaxing and allowing our local school professionals to run their schools. I don't think we should be afraid of that. I don't think we need to micromanage every single decision from here in Madison.
But critics like Corey Mason of Racine, a Democrat, said that in an urban school district like his, where you've got a lot of kids who are challenging to teach, you actually create an economic disincentive for a teacher to go teach in a district like Racine or other urban districts.
You are saying to those teachers, dedicated teachers who've given their lives to educating students in tough districts, your economic security may be at stake. So the smart thing to do is to go to the easier school district, even though the greatest need is in those urban school districts.
Yeah. So, Professor Jacobs, is this a big deal?
Well, I was a little perplexed by this because politically I think it's a little odd. I mean, this is sort of the proverbial poking of the bear with a very sharp stick. I mean, here you see this potential recall of the governor in the offing as well as some members of the state Senate, and you bring this up, which is going to, again, it's just going to rile up those who are affected by the previous bills this year on collective bargaining. So it's a little odd. Plus the comment about micromanaging, it seems as though you're relieving on regulation in some parts, and then you have the abstinence bill in another. So there seems to be a little bit of tension about exactly what they're trying to achieve from the state and imposing upon local school districts.
Yeah. Sean, moving to another issue involving higher education, we don't have time to play the floor debate, but what was this filibuster on, I think it was Tuesday going into Wednesday, over a scholarship program?
Well, there was this very very dull legislative council study bill up on the Higher Education AIDS Board that was, you know, destined to get a unanimous vote in the Assembly. And State Representative Peggy Krusick, a Democrat from Milwaukee, offered an amendment to the plan that would, for this one type of scholarship that the state gives out, for this one type of higher education grant, it would no longer let the state offer that grant based on, you know, someone being black or Hispanic or Hmong or based on their race. And normally when a Democrat offers an amendment, in this case they're the minority party, the Republicans, the majority party just shoots it down. But Republicans decided, you know, we kind of like this amendment, we're gonna support it. And, you know, Democrats just got very angry, and so they filibustered the plan all night. Didn't go home until, I don't know if it was 7:30 or 8, something like that. Turns out, we find out later with that week that the state actually stopped giving out those grants based on race sometime last year.
Yeah, so it was all for naught.
Let's
talk about this. This one is somewhat of a big deal. The Castle Doctrine. Yeah. What is the Castle Doctrine, Sean?
Well, you hear the name of it, Castle Doctrine, and I mean, if you want to oversimplify it, it's talking about the right to protect your own castle. And proponents say it's pretty simple, that when you're in your own home, Racine Senator Van Wongard said, you ought to be able to protect yourselves without worrying about legal repercussions.
Simply put, Wisconsin citizens should not have to be thinking of criminal and civil liability concerns when they are defending themselves or their family in their own homes.
So Democrats said, though, that this is not as simple as it sounds, at least the Democratic critics said. Chris Larson of Milwaukee said you actually could have some pretty dire situations, pretty tragic situations, because of what this bill allows.
You could just as aptly call it the Kill the Milkman bill, or the worst trick-or-treat ever bill, or the death of a salesman bill.
You know, let me ask Professor Jacobs, since we're so short on time, is this that scary?
I'm not sure if it's that scary. Again, I don't think we have that many incidents of it. It just gives a presumption regarding liability, and that it's going to direct a judge to behave in a particular way when you get this kind of suit, assuming that the person who is defending his or her castle was actually in the right, with one exception for whether or not you had or should have had knowledge that it was a police officer who was at your door. I really don't think we're going to see a particularly large scale of cases coming to the court where people are sort of randomly shooting visitors to their door.
Yeah, we have just a minute to go, Sean. The Assembly, there's a big to-do over the Assembly allowing guns in the gallery now that the concealed carry law has taken effect, but you can't hold signs?
Yeah, you still can't hold signs, and last week was one of many many arrests, many people being let out of the gallery for holding signs and for taking pictures. And so, you know, the Assembly gallery rules, as we talked about last week, they now permit concealed weapons, but you can't do a variety of other activities up there, like, you know, read a newspaper, display a sign, take a picture.
And very quickly, because we only have 30 seconds, there is going to be a hearing this week on Governor Walker's Medicaid cuts?
Yeah, it's not scheduled yet, but the clock is ticking on when they have to hold that hearing. And this is over about $500 million worth of Medicaid cuts proposed by the governor. Including, you know, in many cases would give people less generous plans for which they would have to pay more. So a pretty big deal when you look at the number of people that are affected by badger care.
Sean, thank you very much for joining us on your day off. Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio State Capitol reporter, and Charlie Jacobs, who is with St. Norbert College.